What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Joel Mosbacher, discussing gun violence and the Jewish response to it. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Last week we celebrated the 4th of July, our Independence Day here in America. I always enjoy the 4th, and this year there was an additional aspect to the holiday that was particularly important to an American history fan like me, and especially so for a Civil War buff. More about that a little later on the show. We all know that the 4th of July celebrates our Declaration of Independence from Britain, proclaimed in Philadelphia in 1776. Actually, the Declaration was passed on July 2nd, 1776, and it didn't get handwritten in a new copy until the 4th, but you get the idea. We know that it was seen as a kind of new birth of freedom in the world, and that it began the great process of creating America. And we also know that it has been celebrated with parades and fireworks and picnics and lots of fun ever since. Now, as a kind of interesting contrast, my wife Wendy and I happened to be on vacation in Victoria, Canada on July 1st, last Monday, which was Canada Day. We were in full flight from the searing record heats here in Arizona, and we found a lovely temperate climate in that beautiful place. We hadn't actually planned to be there for Canada Day, but it seemed like a fun thing. And from all the Canadian flags hung about, it appeared that the people of our nice neighbor to the north were celebrating with great patriotic pride and joy as well. That morning, somebody at our B&B asked our Canadian server, a native of Vancouver, just what Canada Day was celebrating. And this woman in her 20s, a college graduate, answered, "I'm not exactly sure. Independence or something?" Another Canadian president immediately added, "Yes, of course, independence." But when we asked him how long Canada had actually been independent, he answered, "I'm not sure. You hear lots of different dates and years in school." It turns out that most Canadians who are proud of their clean, orderly, pretty country also have no clear idea of just when their independence from Great Britain really began. This is somewhat understandable because Canadians still have Queen Elizabeth II of England as their head of state. She appears on the currency and on lots of public buildings and gardens and such. Somehow, the British monarchy is still technically in charge of Canada. As odd as this seems to an American, with lots of photos of the Queen's various visits to Canada and previous British royal tours of the provinces, it is just as normal for Canadians to pay lip service to this archaic allegiance. I guess their independence was such a gentle, gradual thing they never quite got over their royal addiction. It is not quite so obvious as it is in England, but at least in British Columbia, the British part is still very much in evidence. Another oddity, on the waterfront in Vancouver, the cruise ship terminal at Canada Place, there was a huge display on the War of 1812 told from the Canadian point of view, and an action-packed theme adventure experience you can take that shows just how exciting the British and Canadian triumph over the invading Americans was in that 200-year-old war. The oddest part about this is that Americans have completely forgotten the War of 1812. We don't even remember trying to invade Canada back then. Oh, and we also kind of think we won that war if we remember it. Anyway, on Canada Day, most Canadians do hang up flags and wear red and white Canada shirts with maple leaves and go out for picnics and to see excellent fireworks, all with Canadian folk and rock bands playing and occasional bagpipes tooting. But they certainly lack the patriotic fervor we jingoistically demonstrate here in America on our own Independence Day. A last thought on Canada. The Canadian Jewish community, like the American Jewish community, has long enjoyed the advantages of living in a free and accepting society, and it has the additional feature of living in a country in which a bit more communal uniqueness is acceptable. If America is the land of the melting pot, in which people from all over the world come here and eventually assimilate and merge into our larger public culture, Canada sees itself as more of a mosaic, in which individual cultures preserve more of their own ethnic and religious uniqueness while being part of the larger, looser society. I'm sure the truth of this varies depending on the culture and the origins of the people, but judging by the Jewish communities in Canada, I can say that they tend to be more traditional, to use more Hebrew, including the Reform Jews, by the way, than their U.S. counterparts. It's as though in Canada, some greater portion of where you come from matters still. I noted earlier on the show that this year's Independence Day has special resonance for me as an American history nerd, and especially as a Civil War buff. This July 1st through the 3rd marked the 150th anniversary of the greatest battle ever fought on this continent, the Battle of Gettysburg. It was also during these same days that the last Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi River was captured by General Ulysses S. Grant at Vicksburg. And these two events limited the high watermark of the Confederacy, which kind of began to spiral downhill after that. You know, even after the epic Federal victory at Gettysburg and the dramatic defeat of the South's great general, Robert E. Lee, there were still nearly 2 years of civil war left to fight. But with Meade's win in Pennsylvania, the tide turned, and slavery's end in America began to appear inevitable. We think of Gettysburg as a close-fought and incredibly dramatic battle, which it was. We see the Union's victory as a critical step in determining the character of the nation ever after. Abraham Lincoln understood that better than anyone, and perhaps since his time that was true too. And when he spoke at Gettysburg in the fall of 1863, remembering the battle whose news reached the North on the 4th of July, 150 years ago, he encapsulated just what the great fight was all about. Freedom, founded on this continent in 1776, but not actually given to all the residents until the last of the battles of the Civil War, and the many legal battles thereafter determined that no American could deprive another of liberty. Much of the imagery and many of the ideas of the period of the Civil War were heavily influenced by the great biblical Jewish images of freedom from slavery, God and Moses bringing the Israelites from servitude to liberty. That most Jewish of images and ideas, the destruction of the bondage imposed by the wicked Pharaoh, can be seen and heard in the speeches of the great orators of the day, read in the editorials that shaped national opinion. I would be remiss if I did not note that although the Jewish population of America was modest in the period of the Civil War, Jews were disproportionately represented in the armies and government of both the North and the South. The earliest wave of Jewish migration to the U.S. came from Sephardic Jews of Spanish and Portuguese descent. They settled in the port cities, both above and below the Mason-Dixon line, New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, Savannah, and New Orleans. That meant that by the time of the Civil War, Sephardic Jews served both the Union and Confederate causes. Most importantly, Judah P. Benjamin, a former U.S. senator who was the power and possibly the brains behind President Jefferson Davis of the Confederacy. Judah Benjamin was at various times Secretary of State, Secretary of War, and Treasurer of the Confederate States of America. And at Gettysburg, there were Jewish soldiers on both sides and Jewish casualties on both sides, too. The second great Jewish wave of immigration to America came from Germany. Most of the Jews settled in the big cities of the North and the new cities of what was then the West, Cincinnati, Chicago, St. Louis. The young men of this immigration wave joined the armies of the North and South, but mostly served the Union. The so-called German regiments of the Army of the Potomac, who had been badly beaten in earlier fights against Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, stood their ground well at Gettysburg and got back much of their honor at a high cost. There were many German Jews sprinkled among the liberal German Christian immigrants in these units. They were considered among the most anti-slavery of all the Union Army's fighters. They'd come to America to find a land of true freedom, without the petty princes and brutal nobles of Germany, who suppressed personal liberty. When they learned of human chattel slavery existing in America, they quickly allied themselves with those who fought to extinguish it. Some of my own ancestors were German Jews from the Rhineland who fought for the Western armies during the Civil War. They were not at Gettysburg, but some were at Vicksburg. In any case, there were German regiments among the Federals who threw back Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, and there were Jewish troops among those shouting Fredericksburg at the captured and retreating Confederates, proclaiming revenge for one of their great defeats a little more than 6 months before. The freedom that was won at Gettysburg was won in part by Jewish troops who came to America to find freedom. We Jews have been part of the fabric of this great country from its earliest moments and at its greatest times, and the inspiration that our teachings have provided has remained a constant throughout American history. Well, enough seriousness for one morning to play us in on this summer day. Here's a patriotic tune from the man who will be the subject of our show a week from now, next Sunday, Alan Sherman, and his remarkable Ode to Fat People.
I would like to explain how it came to pass that I got fat. Ladies and gentlemen, I got fat as a public service. When I was a child, my mother said to me, "Clean the plate because children are starving in Europe." And I might point out that that was years before the Marshall Plan was ever heard of. So I would clean the plate 4, 5, 6 times a day because somehow I felt that that would keep the children from starving in Europe. But I was wrong. They kept starving, and I got fat. So I would like to say to every one of you who is either skinny or in some other way normal, when you walk out on the street and you see a fat person, do not scoff at that fat person. Oh, no. Take off your hat. Hold it over your heart. Lift your chin up high. And in a proud, happy voice, say to him, "Hail to thee, fat person! You kept us out of war!"
That was Alan Sherman's classic, "Hail to thee, fat person," showing us a lighter side of patriotism. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, we'll meet our guest, Rabbi Joel Mosbacher, whose dramatic personal story influenced his deep commitment to combat gun violence in America. Find out how that's going, even how it's possible, when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great, and it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a bid price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish an old friend, Rabbi Joel Mosbacher. Rabbi Mosbacher is the rabbi of Bet Haverim Shir Shalom in Mahwah, New Jersey, and has a really extraordinary story to tell, both a personal story and one that relates to one of the crucial issues in America today. Good morning and welcome, Joel.
It's good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what got you involved with the question of
private ownership of guns, gun violence in America?
Well, this is an issue that I've cared about for a long time, and unfortunately it comes from personal experience. My father was murdered outside of his place of business in Chicago about 14 years ago, and so that's an issue. It's been an issue that's been personal for a long time, and something that I've worked on as a social justice issue for a long time, and especially after the events of Newtown, it felt all of a sudden like a time that maybe I wouldn't be alone in calling for some kind of change, that there was a groundswell of change around this particular issue. So it's something I've thought about, worried about, tried to act on, and I'm trying to work together with many people from across the country now around this issue to try and prevent tragedies, tragedies that we know about, like Newtown and the one in Tucson, and also less visible tragedies like my own personal one.
Your dad had a store in Chicago, and his murder, of course, tremendously traumatic. Was that the result of just somebody being able to have a gun in a robbery as opposed to not having a gun?
Certainly that made a difference. Unfortunately, no one is being held accountable for his murder, which is another part of the story. But, in this case, the time between when he called the police and the time when the police showed up was a matter of 3 or 4 minutes. And in that time, he'd been shot several times. And no doubt he could have been robbed without such a weapon. But no doubt he would have survived had a gun not been involved.
America has a strange relationship with the gun. And I'm sure you've heard it from, many people, because anybody who steps forward and says we need to do something about the way guns are owned in America hears about it. How do you address the question of people's civil rights need to protect themselves?
It's a really important issue. In every bit of work that we've been doing in recent months, we've been careful to say that we're not looking to take all the guns away from people in America, but that we know that when we're not safe, that we have to make some kinds of changes. So we've been looking for unlikely partners, gun owners, NRA members, former police, military people who know that there have to be some kind of reasonable changes that we can make that will not impinge on the rights of gun owners to own their guns, but also to keep us safe. So that's really how we've been framing the issue. And hopefully we're beginning to find unlikely coalition members that recognize that we can't stand idly by when our neighbors are bleeding.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Joel Mosbacher about the question of guns in America and violence when we come back on Too Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Guy, one of the really important and interesting and exciting parts of dealing with Israeli society over the last, 5 to 10 years has been a tremendous innovation, which you championed as a shliach here in our community for so long, for 3 years. Unfortunately, sometimes startups work great and get bought by gigantic companies or become successful gigantic companies themselves, and sometimes they don't work so great. You know, recently Better Place went belly up. The idea of creating electric car network all over Israel, exchanging batteries, still an exciting idea, didn't apparently work in Israel. Let's talk about startups in general. You know, they're always kind of risky, aren't they?
Startups are very risky. That's maybe one of the reasons Israel is so good in doing them, because the Israeli culture allows people to take more risk. But when you're saying taking more risk, you're saying that there are more chances of failure. You know, many times in our lives, people say, oh, yeah, risk taking is a good thing. Being brave is a good thing. But when you're saying to someone, be brave, you're telling them take a risk. Or in other words, you're saying there is a good chance that you will fail.
Right.
And when you're going and investing in a startup company, those chances are very high. Statistics show that not more than 1 out of 10 startups will actually succeed. Not more than 3 out of those 10 startups will be able to break even, meaning gain their losses and, you know, stay on a zero line.
Right. Even break even.
Break even.
Let alone make money.
And at least six out of 10 would significantly fail, meaning that they will lose, and usually they will lose significant amount of money. And I'm not talking here about companies that are only at their preliminary seed funding state, you know, when they're still gaining $100,000 angel money, what is called at the high tech. But I'm talking about companies that are already at a startup phase where you know, their funding is usually around the $5 million, $10 million, sometimes $100 million.
Yeah. So Better Place, it was supposed to have been close to $1 billion that was lost. I mean, that's a big one, but still.
Better Place is a very significant exception, and maybe it's a lesson to be learned by, you know, MBA students in the future, because it was a startup, but from some reason, and there are a lot of reasons into it, I would say maybe marketing reasons, many investors perceived it as not
a startup,
like as a mature,
like
company,
like as a guaranteed company,
right? And their idea was really an amazing idea. Technologically, it could have changed the world, and potentially, if it would work,
it might still,
and if it would work, it would gain billions over billions of dollars. It could replace the entire oil industry for cars, which is huge. So I guess that's the reason why people put $1 billion in there and took the risk. And in this case, it does seem that, at least for now, the risk kind of became real.
We'll have to talk a little bit more about the Israeli character that embraces risk when we talk next week. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk then.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Egypt is now following the path that Turkey seems to have charted accidentally a few weeks ago, where a democratically elected Islamist leader is putting Islamist policies in through an elected legislature, and the people don't like it, and the military doesn't like it, and you get big public protests and demands that he resign. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think we all tend to be too unnuanced in our use of the word Islamist. I mean, what does it mean? Fundamentalist, scary, bad guy, extremist, radical. We use the word too carelessly to the point where I think it's lost any useful meaning. And the two cases are very different. I mean, first of all, Egypt is an Arab country, but it's an Arab country with an ancient civilization and a real sense of national identity and its own specialness. Turkey, of course, is not an Arab country at all. It is a largely Muslim country, but it was the center of the Ottoman Empire for many centuries, and the Ottoman Empire was multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multinational, etc., etc., but definitely not Arab. So in some cases, in some senses, rather, the two cases are not remotely comparable. Since Ataturk in the 1920s, Turkey has a history of secular rule, a real separation of church and state, in a sense, and the army stepping in whenever secularism or the vision of Ataturk was really threatened. Egypt has a very different history. It was a colony for much of the past two millennia, first of ancient Greece, then of ancient Rome, eventually of the Ottomans themselves, then of Britain, and didn't become independent in any meaningful sense until the 1950s, when Nasser basically led a revolt
against King Farouk.
Right. And the case of Egypt is a case where this was one of the countries where the so-called Arab Spring began, with huge demonstrations. Egypt is a much poorer, much less developed, much less Europeanized country than Turkey, where the roots of democracy are not as deep or as strong, where the Islamist tradition is newer in some ways, because the Ottoman Sultan was also the caliph of the whole Islamic world for many centuries. On the other hand, the intellectual capital of the Islamic world was, for many of the same centuries, Cairo. So what the Egyptians are struggling for and what the Turks are struggling for are two very different things. And I think maybe we'll have to wait till next week, but we should make that distinction very clear.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week and maybe explore Egypt in greater detail.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Dr. Goldberg is examining his patient, Mr. Levine. Mr. Levine, you're in great shape. You're going to live to be 80. Levine protests, but I am 80. No, says Dr. Goldberg. Did I lie? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Dvarim, Deuteronomy, the final book in the Torah. The name Deuteronomy captures a midrashic explanation of the essence of this final sefer. It means a repeated text in Hebrew called Mishneh Torah. This reflects the fact that the entirety of the book of Dvarim is a few long sermons by Moses, recapitulating events and commandments established over the previous three books. Not bad work for a man with a serious speech impediment. A word about language in Dvarim, which seems appropriate since the word Dvarim means words. The Hebrew of the book is extraordinary, terse, strong, muscular in quality, carrying a sense of great purpose and power. It has the unmistakable feel of a literary masterpiece, and the language conveys Moses' message of God's explicit direction as clearly as any text in Torah. Sometimes the medium is the message, and so it proves here in the book of Dvarim. The narrative of Deuteronomy begins at the end of the Israelites' journey to the borders of Canaan, the promised land soon to become Israel. Moses informs the people of Israel he has now led them for 40 years, as though they might have forgotten that, and that they have come to the place and time of greatest importance. One of the first incidents he recalls goes back to the time when the Israelites were beginning to get organized. Moses himself had just appointed judges and magistrates to help him with the needs of the people. The great leader Moses remembers the instructions he gave those leaders: be fair and absolutely even-handed in dispensing justice. Do not favor the rich. Do not favor the poor. Show no partiality, but simply seek that which is just and right in the world. This is, of course, just the beginning of Moses' long orations, his last hurrah, so to speak. Although he is now, by biblical calculation, 120 years old, though his control over his people has waned, even though his speech is tinged by the bitter knowledge that he will not get to enter the promised land, still he teaches us, again, the greatest lesson. For we Jews must be pledged to create in this uncertain and even unjust world acts and systems of ethics and justice. What greater calling can any people have? When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Joel Mosbacher, will update us on the status of his efforts to limit gun violence in America and the importance of the Jewish response. When we come back on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
An interesting issue has emerged in Tel Aviv, whether to allow businesses to be open on Shabbat. Until now, in truth, there has been a delicate, successful status quo. The law was that businesses had to be closed, but if they opened, they simply paid a fine. But last week, the Israeli Supreme Court criticized the way the municipality has enforced the bylaw, banning certain types of businesses from being open on the Sabbath. For years, the city has not prevented them from being open on Saturday. Just fined them. The major supermarket chains could absorb the fine, so they continued to be open on Shabbat. But owners of small makolots, grocery stores, and kiosks were forced to shut. The court said that it was unacceptable for the city to essentially tolerate lawbreaking. It gave Tel Aviv 60 days to consider seeking closure orders against businesses that breach the bylaw regularly. But it also stressed that the city could instead opt to amend the bylaw to let businesses be open on Shabbat, if city officials believe the character of Tel Aviv justifies doing that. Mayor Ron Holdai, a past guest of Too Jewish, rejected the court's criticism of how Tel Aviv has acted till now, saying its policy was a fair compromise. In its enforcement policy on Shabbat, the city has followed Herzl's line by being more concerned for its residents' quality of life than for diligently observing Shabbat. But Shabbat in Tel Aviv, Yafo, Jaffa, has been preserved, Holdai said. The city rests, and the decisive majority of the commercial activity that characterized it during the week does not take place on Shabbat. Out of over 50,000 businesses, only a few hundred are open. The negligible income from fines on such businesses is nothing compared to the expense of actually enforcing them, he continued. But the enforcement itself created a reality that the public can live with. And there have been no protests, no clashes. In practice, anybody can enjoy his day off or her day off as he or she chooses. Following the Supreme Court decision, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz queried city council members, found that a clear majority favors changing the bylaws to let businesses that sell food be open either fully or partially on Shabbat. but Huldai is not eager to make any change before October's municipal elections. We're dealing with a serious and important issue for the future of Israeli society. It has implications beyond the boundaries of Tel Aviv, Huldai wrote. Haste and empty slogans should be avoided. The process of preparing a new municipal bylaw on an issue such as this takes months. It's necessary to hold orderly deliberations and consultations with professionals and jurists, in cooperation with all sectors of the populace and government ministers. We will continue to follow this interesting story. Israeli point guard basketball player Gal Mekel has reached an oral agreement with the Dallas Mavericks on a three-year contract to be paid the league's minimum salary last week. The Maccabi Haifa star would become the second Israeli to play in the NBA after forward Omri Kaspi. Since last week, NBA teams have been allowed to negotiate with players in free agency, but contract signings can't start until July 10th. Gal Mekel led Maccabi Haifa to a championship in the Israeli league this year. Although all 3 years of Mekel's deal are guaranteed, a rarity for a player making a jump to the NBA, they'll only be worth the league's minimum salary, which is an easy gamble for the Dallas Mavericks, who stand to gain a rotation-caliber pick-and-roll guard if all goes according to plan. Gal Mekel averaged 13.5 points and 5.5 assists for Maccabi Haifa last season, got the MVP award, and ushered his team to the championship of the Israeli Super League. And finally, a sad note, Rabbi Norman Lam announced his resignation last week as chancellor of Yeshiva University after admitting his failure to respond adequately to allegations of sexual abuse against the university's rabbis in the 1980s. Lam served as president of what is Modern Orthodoxy's premier academic institution from 1976 to 2003, when he was elected chancellor. In general, it has been a time of great growth and success for Yeshiva University, but Norman Lam knew he had not done everything he could or should have done in one important area. As Rabbi Lam wrote in his resignation address, at the time that inappropriate actions by individuals at Yeshiva were brought to my attention, I acted in a way that I thought was correct, but which now seems ill-conceived. I understand better today than I did then that sometimes when you think you're doing good, your actions don't measure up. You submit to momentary compassion in according individuals the benefit of the doubt by not fully recognizing what is before you. And in the process, you lose the promised land. I recognize now that when we make decisions, we risk, however inadvertently, the tragedy of receiving that calamitous report. Tarof, Tarof Yosef, Joseph is devoured. All our work is in vain. All we have put into our children has the risk of being undone because of a few well-intentioned but incorrect moves. When that happens, one must do tshuva. So too, I, Rabbi Lam says, must do tshuva, repentance. True character requires of me the courage to admit that despite my best intentions then, I recognize now that I was wrong. I am not perfect. None of us is. Each of us has failed in one way or another, in greater or lesser measure, to live by the highest standards and ideals of our tradition, ethically, morally, halachically, according to Jewish law. We must never be so committed to justifying our past that we thereby threaten to destroy our future. It's not an easy task. On the contrary, it's one of the greatest trials of all, for it means sacrificing our very egos, our reputations, even our identities. But we can and must do it. I must do it. And having done so, contribute to the creation of a future that is safer for innocence. A remarkable statement from Rabbi Lam. I only wish he had understood this closer to the terrible events he speaks about, the sexual abuse by rabbis at Yeshiva University under his authority. May this new example of his own repentance influence others to move far more quickly and proactively if such terrible things occur in the future. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi Joel Mosbacher. He has a powerful personal reason to be involved in the issue of gun ownership, gun proliferation, gun violence in America. Earlier in the show, he talked about his father's own death when he was shot in his store. Rabbi Mosbacher, when you advocate for gun controls, what are the issues that you're bringing up first? What's the direction that the movement is taking?
The direction that we're working on is actually what we think kind of a unique one. There's been a lot of conversation in this country in recent months about who has the power to make change on this issue. And, you know, Congress has been the primary, the members of Congress and the president have been the primary names whose names we've heard. But what we've begun to notice and think about is that there are many other players in society that have the ability to make change on this issue. Gun manufacturers, gun retailers, major purchasers of weapons, police, military, who buy 40% of the guns in this country with our taxpayer dollars. And so that's really the angle that we're going at. Ultimately, we hope to go to gun manufacturers together with police and military and governors and attorneys general who purchase massive amounts of guns, and together ask them for essentially better customer service, ask them to do research and development on smarter, safer guns, ask them to have responsible distribution practices about how they sell their guns. And so we're really starting at a grassroots level, talking to local mayors, police chiefs, attorneys general, and governors, and inviting them into imagining how we could work together to make our streets safer, make our communities safer. And we're finding a lot of resonant conversation when we have these conversations. Police know much more about weapons, certainly, than I do, and they have ideas about things that that gun manufacturers could do, for example, to make their work better, easier, and to make our streets safer. And so by enlisting their ideas and support and interest, we believe we'll be able to have a powerful voice when we go to visit James Debney of Smith & Wesson and Dennis Villeux of Colt and Ron Cohen of Sig Sauer and Gaston Glock in Austria, because we'll speak with a broad and deep voice that says there have to be sensible changes in the ways that guns are manufactured and distributed in this country.
There had to be a great deal of disappointment, and there certainly was for many, when the federal government failed, when the Congress failed to even enact stricter background checks recently, in spite of the president's very vocal support of many organizations after Newtown, after the attacks in Aurora, Colorado last year, after, of course, the attack in Tucson a couple of years ago. Did this lead to sort of a change in direction, to moving to a more local approach?
I think we had been imagining, we were sort of aware that Congress might be the most dysfunctional institution in America. So while certainly we were working on the legislative side, I think our eyes were already sort of ahead of that ball, because we knew that the odds were stacked against congressional action from the beginning, even with the tragedies that you've mentioned, and also, frankly, our recognition that even had background checks been passed in Congress, that it wasn't sufficient, that it really wasn't going to, it would make a dent, it might make a small impact, but we were looking to see what other ways we could go at this issue, because it is a complex issue. And so when people, sometimes when I'm speaking to people about this issue, and they have a knee-jerk kind of reaction that any conversation about this means it's an impingement on the Second Amendment, and they say it's complicated, I agree with them. There isn't any one power player in this conversation that can make all the change that we want to see. So even as we were lobbying our local legislators and working across many states that our network, our community organizing network, is connected to, on congressional action, we were also beginning to imagine what other steps we might take, who else we might hold accountable for their role and their responsibility, their covenantal responsibility, as we see it, as people of faith, to do the right thing, make changes that really can make a difference on this issue.
What changes would you like to see gun manufacturers make?
Well, some of the things that we'd like to see them do include some of the things that I've already mentioned, which is things like investing in research and development to make guns that only can be fired by the people who own them. Things like responsible distribution systems where they're not selling you know, where they can only sell guns through federally licensed dealers, things like buyback programs, and frankly, we'd like to ask them to stop funding groups who inflame fears in this country around this issue, only to sell more guns.
So, what groups would those be?
So, certainly, we're speaking about the NRA and other groups like them. That when there's any hint of an allegation that there might be a change in gun laws, the NRA pumps out fear ads and fear in the halls of Congress. That we saw the direct result of, that even after a tragedy such as Newtown, that our legislators were afraid to buck the NRA, and the NRA is funded by gun manufacturers. So it's a symbiotic relationship that we would like to we'd like to break, if that's possible. You know, some people might say that is an outlandish thing to hope for, but we speak from a prophetic tradition, and it's our it's our belief that we can that we can make change on this issue. The NRA is not our prime target. The gun manufacturers and gun retailers are, and there are good corporate citizens. Dick's Sporting Goods took their assault weapons off of all the stores, all of their the shelves of their 541 stores across the country after Newtown, and they've done that on a permanent basis, and we think we should celebrate that. We'd like to see Walmart do the same, and other big box store sellers. So there are good corporate citizens out there. We'd like to celebrate them, and we'd like to hold others. There's also things that local police departments can do. We started to talk to police departments about what happens to their old service weapons when they decide to retire their service weapons. And we've heard two kinds of stories. One story is that they sell their old service weapons on private online websites to that can only be accessed by police and military, so that they stay within armed forces' hands. The other kind of story that we hear that's disturbing is sometimes we've asked police departments, what happens to the old service weapons that you trade into the gun manufacturers, which is the other way they can go? And the answer is they don't know. And when that occurs to them, they seem a little alarmed. All of a sudden it occurs to them maybe they should care a little bit about where the old service weapons go, that it shouldn't be that those service weapons get into the hands, that they're resold by gun manufacturers to people who can end up shooting police officers. So we want to invite police departments to be thoughtful as well about how they dispose of their old service weapons, and we would like for them to take into account what we've been calling the social quality of the guns they purchase in addition to the technical quality. So if there are gun manufacturers that are taking more responsible steps with regards to some of the things that we'd like to see, we'd like for that to matter in their decision-making process about what guns they purchase and which ones they don't.
A great percentage of the guns sold in the United States are sold at gun shows, not by gun distributors, not at, officially authorized places which could do background checks. This seems to be becoming more prevalent rather than less so. What can be done about that?
Well, I think it starts with how the guns are sold in the first place. And so that's why we'd like to see gun manufacturers make at least the initial sales only through federally licensed dealers. There's always going to be the opportunity for people to buy guns in a legal way and either use them in crimes or resell them in a way that's harmful. So we're not quite there in attacking that particular issue, but we believe that if it starts from the manufacturer in a more responsible sales way, then it will reduce some of the gun show issue. And also, if there was federal legislation, as it seems so tantalizingly close, that we would be closing the gun show loophole and that there would be requirements to do background checks at gun shows across the country, that would certainly be a good good step in the right direction on that front.
There's a great deal of puzzlement among many of us as to why there'd be such resistance to just very simple background checks that would prevent convicted felons, people who are mentally ill, from purchasing guns quite legally and ammunition for them. What's the justification that's given for that?
It's really baffling to me. I wish I had an answer for that when statistics show that something like 70% of NRA members believe that there should be such background checks. It's baffling to me why such a thing wouldn't be put into place when that seems to be, in many ways, the lowest of lowest hanging fruit. So I wish I had an answer for that. If I did, then others would, and we would have at least had background checks by now out of Congress. But I genuinely don't know what the resistance to even that basic level of common sense legislation is.
On a Jewish level, this is a Jewish show. Your dad was a Jewish guy killed by a gun. And there are, in my congregation, gun owners and NRA members, as there are in most, the most liberal reform synagogues in America. What's the Jewish approach to explaining the need? What's the best thing that people can do as responsible people of faith?
I've really talked about it as not standing idly by our neighbor's blood, that when our neighbors are bleeding, we have to figure out what we can do to staunch the bleeding. And also the idea that we are our brother's keeper. What the Bible meant by that was probably just literally our brother and our neighbor was the person who lived right next door. But in this world in which we live, our brothers and our neighbors are people in Tucson and people in Aurora and people in a Sikh temple in Milwaukee and children in a schoolhouse in Newtown, Connecticut, and that we as people of faith have an obligation to not stand idly by the blood of our neighbor, to be our brother's keeper, and to figure out ways that we can staunch this bleeding. The prospects are daunting. This past week's Torah portion was Shlach Lecha, and I talked about this issue from the perspective of the 12 spies who go out to scout out the land, and the 10 come back and say, essentially, the people there are too powerful, they're too organized, there's too much political interest and too much money, we can't defeat them. And Joshua and Caleb come back and say, it's going to be challenging, but we can do it, and we have to do it. And I think that people of faith of different political persuasions understand that something needs to change on this issue, and one of those ways it can change is through legislation. Another way it can change is through distribution policies and common sense research and development and buyback programs and all the kinds of things that we're talking about that won't prevent people who own guns, responsible gun owners, from owning them or getting them, but will prevent people who shouldn't have guns from having them. And I think that's in everybody's interest, gun owners and non-gunners, owners alike, Republicans, Democrats, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Sikhs. It's in all of our interest to be safe. And that's what this is about. And most people that I've spoken to who are willing to even have any kind of conversation about this understand it. People who aren't willing to have any kind of conversation about it, well, there's just no conversation to be had. But that doesn't represent the vast majority of people that I've encountered in these past months and years since my own experience.
Al Talmud, Al Damreyacha, don't stand idly by the blood of your neighbors. I want to thank Rabbi Joel Mosbacher for not standing idly by and for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Good luck. Where can people go to find out more about what they can do?
We have a website called donotstandidlyby.org, and you can find out more about the covenant that we're proposing and more about what you can do in your local community, speaking to your mayor and police chief and on up from there.
Thanks so much, Joel.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be author Mark Cohen, talking about his new book on the late great Jewish parodist Alan Sherman called Overweight Sensation. Our playout this morning comes from a brand new CD by Canadian comedian Rick Moranis, an actor, of course, just released. The song is called Poo Poo Poo. It's a terrific and very entertaining one, and perhaps the song and the album itself are just a little bit too Jewish. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Feldman's man, did they look great? Mindy graduated with a 3.8. Milty says they're just about to renovate. And don't tell anybody, but Debbie is late. Poo, poo, poo. Poo, poo, poo. When it's good to be true. Poo, poo, poo. Murray was indicted for insider trading. They moved the case to Delaware, they're sitting and waiting. Running up a legal tab, their hopes were fading. Then Murray and the judge's sister started dating. Poo, poo, poo. Poo, poo, poo. When it's too good to be true. What you like, a superstition? For me, it's just a logical position. I'm not claiming honest premonitions, just historically informed intuition, an evolutionary predisposition. Possibilities of triggering a juicy Kanahara. Say what you like about me, but be careful, don't commit Lashon Hara. Horrible disasters happen easily, believe me, check the Torah. Brides fall off chairs, a moil might sneeze, bar mitzvah boys can trip onto a